Welcome to the All of Christ for All of Life podcast, brought to you by Canon Plus. This week's episode is the latest episode of Doug Wilson and Friends on the topic, Why Everything is Political Now. It's a conversation between Pastor Douglas Wilson, Dr. Joe Rigney, Jared Longshore, and me, Wade Stotts.
Welcome to Doug Wilson and Friends. This is Doug Wilson, and here are the friends.
Here we go.
I'm Joe Rigney.
It all works
out. It's always there. I'm Joe Rigney, and joining us today, Dr. Jared Longshore, and the one, the only, Wade Stotts.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, way to go, Wade.
Thank you.
You made it. You made it to the show.
It's a pleasure.
This is great. It is the March edition of Doug Wilson and Friends, which means it's actually the post Super Tuesday, so the like sort of decent Wednesday edition of this. So maybe kick it off there. It looks like we now have our candidates.
It looks like it. Yes.
How are you feeling about that?
I'm feeling ambivalent is not the right word. More. I haven't decided yet if they're going to do a switch on Biden yet.
Oh, it's okay.
Right. So I'm not sure that we
have them.
So
and they could be forced to at this point.
It could be demand. It could be. In other words, I don't want to say that it's impossible for it to get crazier between now and November.
Right.
Just don't talk that way.
So yeah, what's your thought if it stays basically like it is, if it's Biden Trump, what are you prognosticating from Super Tuesday?
What I'm prognosticating is that if it's not close, they can't cheat.
Okay.
Okay. If it's an overwhelming tsunami, then they can't cheat. But a red wave was promised 2 years ago and didn't materialize. So you would think that there would be a red wave,
but Trump wasn't on the ballot and he brings in people that don't normally vote, period. And so there's things like that might. Right.
Yeah. So I'm anticipating a decisive, I think that Trump is going to win if it's a head to head matchup, but, And people say, and when I'm talking about cheating, I'm not talking about middle of the night Fulton County or dirty deeds in Maricopa County or I'm not talking about those
systems,
things like although that. I think that those have some merit or some substance. I'm not talking about that. Molly Hemingway's book, Rigged, did a marvelous job of just laying out all the high profile at high noon, middle of the day cheating as evidenced by the attempt to remove Trump from the ballot. That's cheating. The Fannie Willis in Georgia, that's cheating.
Yep.
Jack Smith, that's cheating. Basically, it's all the lawfare.
Right.
Thumb on the scale. We don't want to let the people have a vote.
Would you include like the flood the zone with absentee ballots and then they all come back looking nice? And so the real ballots, they were really sent out, but like who filled them out, that kind of thing?
Right. Yeah, I am as dubious as all get out when it comes to mail-in ballots and all of that. But all of that said, Biden was really a run from the basement candidate before. It was a low energy campaign. His campaign rallies were a joke, and now it's
worse
than that. You know, if Biden won over Trump, I think a sock puppet could have won over Trump.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's possible. So there you go.
Do you think if they switch it, do you think that how does that change your calculus? Like if they do a switcheroo, if he's incapacitated because he could die, like he's that old and it's clearly he's declining.
Right. He could die.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. He'd get Epstein. Like there's all sorts, like there's things like that could happen.
Right.
If they had to, or if they just subbed it at the last minute at the convention.
Right.
Do you think that's a Hail Mary for them?
No, it depends on who they subbed in.
Okay.
So if they subbed in Michelle Obama, for example, I think when you look at how deeply invested the media is in pretending that Biden's doing a great job and he's on top of his game and I think that, don't you people have, do you think we're stupid or what are you doing? But if someone like Michelle Obama, they wouldn't have to do a whole lot of pretending. They could they could create legitimate
excitement.
Hype,
legit
hype. And then it would be a different – that would be a different ballgame. If they put in someone like Gavin Newsom
– Right. Or just promoted Kamala Harris –
Well, I don't think they're up to that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but I mean, like that would be a bad idea.
Yeah. It's a similar problem to Biden,
right?
You know, but if Gavin Newsom, his problem is an appalling record in California,
and he would be stepping in between. You would be taking it away from the first African American woman,
right?
Candidate, and so and you're replacing her because she should be it. So if it's Michelle Obama, that's okay. But if it's him, white dude for the Black lady.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
You think that's it? Similar thoughts?
I'm personally looking forward to the freest and the fairest, the new freest. Last time we had free and fair, this is going to be so
even
free.
Better than even that.
Free and freer.
Crazy free.
UN certified.
Yeah.
So we talk a lot about how we're in for a bumpy ride in 2024. Part of that is because everything is political. And that you did a video.
Yep.
Everything is political, where you kind of brought out Carl Schmitt and his sort of idea of friend enemy.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it was a pretty big hit. Like it sounded like lots of views, lots of feedback. Is that fair?
It did really well on Twitter. A lot of folks enjoyed it.
A lot of folks kind of said, "Oh, this is really helpful." So part of what I wanted to talk about is why. Like why do you think that resonated so much in the present moment, this idea that everything is political?
Because Brutus is in the bathroom with your daughter, so it's like I mean, it's just undeniable. I watched, I just told you before, right before we turned the cameras on, I watched Wade's clip and I was like, yeah, precisely. That's exactly what's going on. So, you know, where are the guns?
That's a good question.
Yeah, that's kind of true. So, it's gotten to the point where the charade is not possible anymore. There's a lot of middle-class Americans who wanted to pretend that the old America that they grew up in was still functioning. And they were just in denial, and it's no longer possible to function in denial.
Yeah, and I'd let Wade actually answer the question. You'll be more insightful, but I would mark. I've been in Moscow 2 years now, and there was recently a faux pas kind of in the evangelical Christian Reformed Twitter world over trad wives and the place of traditional women and then faking it on the internet. And there's a big faux pas there. And you say, well, why? Well, in part because we're how many years now past the sexual revolution? And that's a structural change to society. And people outside of healthy communities, like in Moscow, are just absolutely fed up with the faulty structure of society itself. That's institutional. That comes to ecclesiological, educational, the male, female in society, the political structure. We know that there was corruption in the last election. So you're looking around at all of the structures that are going to create a healthy society, one where you can just live, and be a happy citizen. And they're just flattened. Yeah. Now, if you're in a place and if you're in a healthy community and they're few and far between, then some of the pressure is off. Right, you can operate and you can live and you can sing the psalms with your kids, but if you're in other places, it's really really bad. So basically, what your clip, it's not surprising at all that it went viral because it shows how conservatives really are fed up.
Yeah, I think people have felt that creep, where there used to be that at least I had a few places I could go that were safe or that I didn't feel like I was constantly being attacked. But yeah, that creep has happened. And you talked about the time when things used to function a little bit better. I think, and we had this story that developed that covered that. I think I've lived in a time where it's been the case that we've been covering up the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So that since I was born in the 90s. So since that time, we've been covering things up. And then it can only happen.
Your entire life.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so it's that belief would be a throwback to before I was born. Right. But still, the people... it was sort of handed down to all of us that we had moved past conflict and that everything there really was a time before where there was less conflict. I've lived during a time where.
Here's the question. So like part the video is based on this idea, the Schmittian principle, Carl Schmitt, of friends and enemies, that friends band together to sort of preserve a way of life, maintain a way of life. Enemies threaten that way of life. And in it, you noted that this sort of like like the reason he's hot right now is that he explodes the myth that we've kind of want to believe. It's a phenomenological statement. It's not a, this is how it ought to be.
Right.
This is a, just what it is. So I'm curious, like when are the Schmidtian times and when are the non-Schmidtian times? Are there times where you really do have this friend enemy thing operative, and then there's times where that's not true? If we look back in American history, just since that's the one we're probably most familiar with, when were the times when it was, that was not Schmidtian, that was normal? And then when are the times where it was Schmidtian, and when it was it Schmidtian and covered over? So like that, cause I think that's part of the issue, is like there's this, it's the myth lives on after the normal. The normal's there, then the myth takes root, and the myth survives long after the structure's changed. So give me some
timelines. I was born in 1953 and grew up in a basically unified America with robust political campaigns, but they were really intramural campaigns. Two people running for class president in the same high school.
Yeah.
Right. But we're all loyal Tigers, or we're all, you know, whatever the mascot of the high school was. And anybody who's a thoughtful Christian understands that the antithesis between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent is a constant through all human history, through wars and through peacetime, through empires, through failed states. The antithesis is always there. But there are times of relative peace where people paper over that antithesis, and they don't really succeed. But they succeed for a time, and everybody truly believes it, right? You know, both sides buy into the same myth, right? And a good Bible teacher is going to say that's just a myth. This is going to give way at some point. If you read the Federalist Papers, before the Constitution was ratified, they're worried about the regional conflict between North and South.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they had eyes in their head. They could see this coming. So you can see the fault lines, and you can say, well, there's going to be a big one. There's going to be a big earthquake here in California sometime, or Seattle sometime. But you can have a generation or two of peace and people getting along. So I grew up in a unified America, what is now sneeringly called the post-war consensus, but it was a true consensus, and it was a patchwork job. It didn't really address the issues, and now we're seeing all of those antithetical root assumptions coming to fruition.
Yeah.
And now it's not Harry Truman Democrats and Eisenhower Republicans. Now it's orcs and elves. You know, this is Helm's Deep.
In the friend enemy dynamic. So if that was the 50s, then you went through there's a whole season there, and I don't know where you would run it. Up until the 80s, where there were friends and enemies, but it was being papered over, and maybe not perfectly. Maybe there were skirmishes and such. Yeah. But I'm convinced that what's happened now, and this is why I think maybe your clip would be so hot, is the friends, the good guys, they don't, the generation, I would say, below me, right? I'm about to turn 40, below me, they don't have a way of life. They don't have a culture worth defending.
Mm-hmm.
They've heard about it. They heard about what it was like.
Seen movies.
They've seen movies. Cheers. You know, where everybody knows. They can go to a place where everybody knows their name, and they're always glad you came. Like, where's that?
Nice,
they don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, sounds nice. Like, they grew up on like Friends.
Sure.
They grew up on like, you know, was it Ross and what's her name?
Yeah,
you know?
We'll have to ask Jake.
Yeah.
Jake definitely.
And
knows.
So there's a level of despair and blackpilling that's so easy to go for, because you're like, well, yeah, now we know that we should have been.
Yeah.
Now we know that our fathers should have been fighting and maybe weren't doing what needed to be done.
Yeah.
And what do you do now other than like a collapse and then a revival? So we trust the Lord for a revival. But I think there has to be a dying if there's going to be any kind of rising, because the guys below me are going, we don't even know, other than we've heard about it, but we've never tasted what it's like to have that kind of culture that's worth defending.
Yeah. And part of what helped paper over a lot of that enmity in America during the post-war period was strong visions of external enemies. Mm-hmm. So we had the Cold War, and we had just beat the Nazis. So yeah. We had plenty of things to sort of unite around and say, we are one people that's done something or is going to do something, or if things get bad, then we're going to really show them. And so that helped, at least helped us not see some of the festering problems that would have been more obvious otherwise.
So there you've got, so the friend enemy is still operative, but the enemy is a foreign enemy.
Yeah.
That's kind of the idea, right? Yeah. And so the existential threat to your way of life, it's a threat to the American way of life, and it's communist or it's Nazi. Or you go back and you can see, I suppose you could see this in the Civil War, where the reason it was able to be papered over for a while from the founding till the Civil War was there was sort of two different ways of life, but they didn't necessarily interfere with one another. And then the more that they began to interfere with one another, the more that tensions rose. Yeah. And I suppose even before that, in the American War for Independence, it's a similar thing. That's more of a jurisdictional claim, and probably why it was able to be resolved without the existential.
Well, yeah, because in the War for Independence, there was an ocean between the two ways of life.
Right.
And in the War between the States, there was many days travel between the two ways of life. And it was a little complicated in the border states. But now, the reason I think the clip took off is because the way of life that people are rising up to defend is our red state way of life. And the blue state is just a few miles that way.
Right. Or even like, this is, I think, even one of the challenges is that we think of it, like it always gets talked about in terms of red state, blue state, but it actually is intrastate. Like within each state, you're going to have, in red states, you're going to have blue dots. In blue states, you're going to have large swaths of red, farmland and rural towns. And so it's always just right around the corner.
Well, look up, there are maps that'll produce this. Look up red counties, blue counties.
Right.
Right? And you're going to see that it's not just between state and state. Mm-hmm. It's between the western side of Washington, past the past the Cascades, and then eastern Washington, which is
just western Idaho.
Western Idaho.
Well, I have a question following up on this. So the red, now that we've got red blue, and this relates maybe to the election Super Tuesday stuff, do you men think that red and blue will be the friend enemy? That is there enough, say, commonality? Is there enough culture? Are there enough common customs and traditions among the red to actually form an entity, or is that red entity going to collapse? Does it not actually have what it takes to stand as friends?
I think there's enough commonality to stand in a big conflict. But let's say they prevail in the conflict and tried to form the United Red States of America. There are going to be immediate challenges.
Yeah, so then you'd have a fracturing. That's where you got a bunch of Christian. I saw today somebody was talking about the part of what's going on with the Christian nationalist discussion is that Christians are having a sort of self-conception of like, no, we have a way that we want to do it. And we've normally just been passengers in a bus that somebody else was driving. Somebody else was driving the red bus, and we were just passengers on the red bus. And now it's gotten so bad that there's Christians who are like, I think we should drive.
That's true.
And I think we should drive. And all of a sudden, not only is the other bus worried about that, right?
But our bus is
worried about that and would just as soon keep us, seated.
It's mostly the bus driver's union that's worried about
it. I mean, you count me in. I think you spoke to my soul right there. We've passed the offering plate because I'm like, no, I mean, that's it. And I do not want, I want Christians driving. I don't think we can do it anymore. Like, somebody have to talk me off the ledge, but I'm like, we have to.
Right.
We have to drive or we're just going to go over the cliff.
And I think that one point is that mass media has certainly changed a lot of this. And so that friend and enemy can be located next door to each other, such that they're just being influenced by different things. They're sort of holed up in their spots. And so what Christians have is more unity, and which means that those friend enemy dynamics are going to be, at least you understand, I don't know, it because it's being so flattened out, it's almost like there are pockets of ways of life that we want preserved, But there's sort of a national way of life that I think needs to be built now. Mm-hmm. So that seems to be like the next phase.
But Christians are the ones who have church communities.
Yeah.
Right. Name any other group that within Red State America that meets weekly with people that they know and get together with, you know. There are people involved in sports teams and rodeo and that sort of thing, but there's nothing like the church infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And even if the church were a secular thing, just the Kiwanis or something, if you were meeting that often and knew people, there's a built-in network that is going to give Christians the advantage in this post-crisis discussion. Right.
How do you, so it seems to me that part of, like when I've thought about the challenge, I wasn't thinking about it in Schmidtian terms necessarily, but it fit. It's sort of like, you know, Lewis talked about the Tao, natural law that's sort of embedded in creation, but is always instantiated or incarnated in a particular way of life. So when I would, when I watched your video, I thought, I picked up on that. There's a way of life. It's not just sort of on a piece of paper. It's not just the Constitution, but it's a Constitution as a representation of a way of life. That's a symbol of something bigger and more holistic and incarnated. So Lewis talks, you know, natural law's got to be worked out someplace. And it's going to look different in different places. So the German way of doing it and the English way of doing it and the American way of doing it are going to look different, even but they could all be expressions of the Tao. So it seems like now, like, you know, his point in Abolition of Man was now we're having a fight over those who just want to throw the Tao away. It's just gone. How does that contribute to the feeling of existential threat in America in particular as the biggest, baddest nation, as the hegemon? Why does that existential piece of like the absence of the Tao, how does that factor in?
Well, the absence of the Tao reduces to the absence of man.
Yep.
That's why it's the abolition of man.
Right.
So if you lose the Tao, you can't lose the Tao and keep humanity.
Yep.
You can't lose the Tao and keep the idea of boys and girls. It's just not possible. So it's the political parties now reduced to those who believe in being human and those who believe in not being human. There's no such thing as being human. Well, then on the being human side, there are a bunch of Judeo-Christians or people just on autopilot, but the Christians among them ought to be self-consciously meditating, teaching, and being very noisy about this. The reason I was thinking on this after I saw your clip, the reason everything is political is because we are formally atheistic. Okay, so if there is no God above the state, as Francis Schaeffer argued, then the state is God. And if the state is God, they have to assume all the prerogatives of deity, which omnipresence, wrath, promulgation of law. You know, they saw a job opening. They eliminated God and saw a job opening. So the state, man's collective idea, promoted itself and rose to fill the top spot. Okay, and that's why everything is political. Everything's political for the same reason that for the Christian, everything is God-saturated. In him we live and move and have our being. Well, now, with this idolatrous construct, they want us to live and move and have our being in it.
Everything in the state, nothing outside the state. Yeah. That sort of the fascist slogan from...
Correct. And there's no alternative. So either Christians name the name of Christ and say, we will not go along with your program because Jesus is Lord of the United States. And yes, I want a constitutional amendment that incorporates the Apostles' Creed. That's what I want. Mm-hmm. Right. And then everybody, the bus driver's union.
So Heidi Presbola, stop saying that our rights come from Congress.
And the great thing about the Tao point is that each one of those nations that then instantiates natural law, they can at least understand that you over there, you love your piece of ground and you love that because that's where your ancestors are buried and that's where you've got a history there and you love it. And those kind of nations that are expressing natural law in different ways can at least understand each other and have a different kind of relationship.
If I love my mom, I know why you love yours.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas now, the enemy is not somebody who loves a different piece of ground from you, or somebody who's trying to encroach on, but somebody who's trying to destroy property. Right. Who doesn't want any you to be attached to any piece of ground.
Right.
And so it's a different kind of struggle than I think most political struggles in the past, but it is political.
That's really good and scary. But and that's weird because that means that the bad guys don't love their ground.
Yeah,
right.
Which is super weird, which is showing like what's going on. And they don't love their heritage either.
Well, that's because they live in hotels.
Right?
Yeah. No, they fly to Dev. They fly around the world, jet set.
Yeah,
fighting climate change
up in the air,
in the cloud, right?
In the cloud,
they live in the cloud. So we're dealing with a creepy manifestation of like a different conception of the world from the bad guys. You'd almost rather them be like this is our territory. Draw a line.
Right. Yeah,
but they don't have those kind of instincts, and therefore can't.
It's sort of different. Like maybe these are. It just occurred to me, like sort of the Putin. You know, in the Tucker interview is like, let's go back to 800. And, you know, he's like, this is our ancestral land and we're just taking it back.
Right.
And that's how you have to understand our conflict in terms of ancestral claims to the land.
Right.
Which is a different sort of, so there's a friend enemy thing, right? Ukraine and Russia things are there's enemies and it's an attack on a way of life. And it's a sort of, but it's operating in a different sort of frame than what we're talking about because it's not tethered to place. It's not human. Yeah.
You will live in the pod, but you won't be attached to it in any way.
Right. You can substitute.
You won't love your pod in any particular way.
Right. Why, and the Russia-Ukraine war is a bad business, but it's an old-fashioned war. It's a war from another era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's territorial both ways. It's got a long history on both sides.
Yep.
And
I think that maybe that's a question. So I two questions. One is, you know, in the old non-Schmittian time in America, when it was Eisenhower Republicans and Truman Democrats, you know, we were talking earlier before we got on here, you know, politics stopped at the water's edge.
Right.
And so there was, and you mentioned the external threats can sort of shore up internal conflict. Yeah. They can temporarily paper over because we're all Americans. And so let's all get to the wall, everybody. It seems like now it's kind of flipped. To the point where the foreign policy stuff is proxy war for internal conflict, right? So, so it's like, you know, any thoughts on that? Like the way that it was like that the conflict with another nation would make us all band together because we're all Americans. Even like after 9/11, just sort of that everybody was like, we're all Americans. That was New York, and it may be liberal, it may be progressive, it may be blue state, it may be whatever, but that's still America.
Yeah.
And so, and George Bush can go into Yankee Stadium and everybody cheer, even though, you know, a bunch of those people didn't vote for him at all, but he's our president. Mm-hmm. And then now it seems like if there was something similar, the reaction would not be to sort of circle the wagons as Americans, but instead, to immediately go, you guys, you blue state, you know? So like, if there's a terrorist attack from within, the immediate reaction, I mean, like my first thought is going to be, well, did they come across the border?
Right.
Did they sneak in across the border and embed
themselves? Was it a false flag?
Yeah, you immediately sort of have, it's a different set of questions because you're, you know that there's enemies out there, you know, Islamic jihadists who still want to destroy the West, you know, that the commies would love to take us down a peg and they gave us TikTok in order to do it. but like what, when, if they were to do something, our first thought would be more red, blue.
Right. Yeah, which is why it's important for people to draw a connection between Putin and Trump, the proxy war thing, where people just want to make sure, okay, they want to drum up, there's all this anti-Trump sentiment, then we'll just sort of channel that into anti-Putin sentiment, we'll get people to send money to Ukraine, everything will work out.
But I do wonder, like I think Doug indicated this earlier, if there's a big enough fire,
right?
I think part of it could be just the fires aren't big enough. I mean, if there were a Pearl Harbor situation, I do wonder if that is, and I'm thinking fourth turning. I mentioned,
I think it'd have to be a Martian invasion.
Martian invasion. That's right.
I think a Martian invasion.
A Martian invasion is how we're going from the fourth turning to the first turning. That's going to be the thing.
There's going
to
be a new one, a fifth turning. That's a new turning for that one.
Mars attacks, and then we're good. So here's a question. So we're talking about this, and it seems like, you know, we've kind of got at least a general sense of like seeing the same thing. What, how would you think about, how do you think about like the persistence of the myth? Like, because I think even among a lot of evangelicals, that there are some who are sort of going like, oh, it's bad. And they watch something like that and go, yes, this resonates. This is, I see it. And then there's others who are just absolutely dead set on, that's not it. Or want to say, it's always been like this. And so nobody needs to do anything differently. We don't need to operate in any different way because, you know, it's seed of the woman, seed of the serpent sort of stuff. And so it's business as usual because it's always been like this.
Well, this goes back to Jared's point, because I think a lot of them have lived their whole lives in a subculture, an evangelical subculture, and they see things on the news, and they still do, but it doesn't impact their day-to-day life, really. They went to a Christian school, graduated from Christian school, went to a Christian college, then went to seminary. They've never spent any time around pagans at all, and they hear about them, and now they're still hearing about them. And so it's easy within their cocoon, within their bubble, to say it's not that bad. You know, my fridge still works.
Right. Yeah. So if somebody were to say we have a real racial conflict problem in America, then they would say, "Well, I don't. I have friends who we're doing just fine. But overall, as a country, we've got a certain problem. But just because they can't say, or we've got an immigration problem, but that doesn't show up in my neighborhood. So right. I guess we're okay.
And when it comes to dealing with those guys, because we probably connected to a lot of these guys. We can envision what they would say, maybe leaders in the evangelical world or such. I just think there's no need to worry about it because they're gonna come. I mean, the next 10 years, they won't be able to maintain that position. And what we need is, I think you said this recently in a sermon, it was related to revival about stacking wood for the altar.
Yeah.
Right? And we got talking recently about taking that concept, but related to like actual structural, the wood for the fire is the structure or the key ingredients that you need to actually have a culture and to have a way of life. Mm-hmm. And it's disintegrating everywhere else. And there's other people that are trying to say, well, it hasn't disintegrated enough for my local spot for me to really do anything about it. But I think we just need to deal with guys that clearly understand that we have to be building, we have to be stacking wood, structural wood. And this is going to require to be in a certain context with other people. It's going to require resources and funding, but a clear vision that, okay, we're dealing with an old altars that have been built by pagans that are now actually have been set on fire, right? Mm-hmm. In Minneapolis was where it lit. And we actually just need to not worry about those who aren't coming yet. They're going to come and marshal men that know it's time to actually stack the wood and ask the Lord to...
This goes back to the saying that is... become commonplace in our circles, which is people who know what time it is. And a lot of evangelicals are right on the threshold of coming into an awareness of what time it is. And hence the...
So is the time... I think that may be a question. So for us, we're trying to do the kindling thing. We're trying to build something that would be able to withstand, or that if God's gracious, we'll be able to withstand... whatever's next, fourth turning, fifth turning, whatever that was. There's other places though where people are still in churches and communities that feel insulated. So I think I was recently in the South and was talking to a pastor there, and that was his comment. He's like, a lot of these folks don't feel like it's that bad because they're in, you know, this is still the Bible Belt, and there's still a ton of churches, and we're insulated from a lot of it. Now, you go to public school, and you probably find all the stuff's there, but they're insulated from it. And so they're just kind of chill. Let's just go have our barbecue. Then there's folks who are in big urban areas who are more compromised than they probably realize, right? Like, in other words, like the woke stuff is sort of filtered in ways that they may not even be self-conscious of. So... for people in those who do know what time it is, you know, the sort of folks who would watch a video like this, I think that there's going to be a tension between how much time do I spend trying to persuade my fellow congregants, you know, like be the guy who jumps on the table and says, no, really, they're coming. The orcs are coming. versus doing something more, is it more productive? Like, how much time on persuasion of your existing community versus... let's get out of our existing community. Let's partner up with the four or five families who know what time it is, and let's do something together. And forget about, like you said, they'll get it when the shooting starts. they'll probably point the guns in the right direction.
Or maybe it'll be pretty soon. Maybe the federal government will try to outlaw gas-powered barbecue.
Now those are fine words. Yeah. That's a Martian invasion.
It's over.
I think this is we're very much a Kate. Was it Kate Millett that did the gathering and the? What are we here to do? What are we here to do? Cultural revolution. How are we going to do it? Destroy the American patriarch. Destroy the family. Promote promiscuity. 1960s revolution stuff. I think it's time for that. It's time for that on the good guy side. So you need to get these people. Now, if you're in somewhere, if you're like baked in somewhere, you know, Tennessee, Georgia, and you've got a nice little hamlet where you have four or five families that get it, and everything about your broader culture is still healthier, right, than other places.
Right.
Your big problem is the generation that's coming up, they're like these people that they don't love their land. They don't love their soil. They live in the cloud. They live in the hotels. And so if you can disciple that generation, I would say go for, you've got some context there that's going to be good. That's going to be helpful, but you've got to get together and actually start planning. It's that time.
The thing I would say there goes back to the point about natural law, because I want to say natural law, yes, three cheers for natural law, but not three cheers for just natural law.
Right.
Because I want natural law in a Christian framework,
right,
which has to entail special revelation. So I think what we ought to be doing in nominal Christian places or complacent Christian places or Judeo-Christian places is be pressing the name of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Christ is a king. He's not a committee chairman. He's the king. And we need to acknowledge him. Why aren't we acknowledging him? That sort of thing, rather than everything being negative, because you're not going to be able to persuade someone that everything's falling apart when his life is not falling apart yet. He'll remember what you said
right.
when it does.
Yeah.
But I would say try to persuade your friends and acquaintances, family members, until the point where it's causing friction with them.
Right.
Don't break fellowship over it. Just say, put it out there, and once or twice, maybe three times, and if they say, leave me alone, man, I'll say, okay, all right.
If everybody, when you walk in the room, if everybody starts rolling their eyes,
right.
Oh, here we go again.
Here's the Thanksgiving rune.
Yeah.
And if this really is about preserving a way of life, it makes sense that you'd want to start by building something that's worth preserving.
Right.
And we can all do that in different ways, in big ways, small
guys,
ways.
That's a tough question, too. I mean, it's a material question for a young guy that's looking to build a way of life. And he's got to look around and go, do I have movers and shakers in this community that are at least halfway enlightened? Like halfway, because it takes resources. And there is a time for a guy to go, I'm looking around and nobody is with me. Well, you've got to get with people that get it. And that's a judgment call that you can move. Mm-hmm. You can move way too soon, obviously. I think the burden of proof is going to be on moving. But it's at that point in our society where if you're looking around, you go, man, I'm listening to all these podcasts and I'm doing it in my own family, but there's not a single soul around. You've got to find
in tornado country, when the siren goes, people know where to go, mm-hmm. right? Here's the drill. This is what we do. In a school, there's a fire alarm. People know what to do. When this alarm goes, when the crisis upon us, when the alarm goes, if you know that siren is coming, you know that crisis moment is coming, and you have no idea where you could go, there's not going to be a rallying point. There's not right. going to be anybody to call. If there's no notion, then I think you need to move to some place where you know what you would do. Because your first responsibility is to your family and to protect your family. And there are good, healthy spots around the country where mm-hmm. if the crisis hits, you know who you'd gather with. You know what mm-hmm. you'd do. But there are also many places where you no idea.
When we think about the Schmidtian thing, one of the objections that people often make to thinking this way, especially about internal politics, is to think about our fellow citizens as enemies, basically seems to remove the possibility of persuasion. We're no longer trying to persuade. So I think this is some of what even your video got into was, this isn't a debate club. This isn't, you know, we're all, let's go make the speech and see whoever wins. But then it seems to become more about just power, like who's got the power and who can make other people do or not do things that they want to do. Is that right? Is like, so does thinking of the present American situation in friend, enemy, Schmidtian terms, remove persuasion from the equation, and instead it becomes simply a matter of power? And how do we think about the fact that, you know, the enemy thing is where I think a lot of Christians still balk at, I don't want to go there. And that's when they retreat to the myth of, well, no, we've always had procedural, we've got debates, we've got Congress, we've got all these ways, elections, free and fair. They retreat to those as a way of avoiding the implication of, if this is that grave, then it seems like more different means.
An illustration I used before is an American sailor at Pearl Harbor as the third wave of zeros flies overhead. And he says, the time for nuance has passed. There are certain, even in a war, even in a hot conflict, there will be persuasion, right? There will be people who, generals in Hitler's army wanting to broker a truce, and people in his command who wanted to, we're going to try and assassinate him. There, depending on how the war goes, depending on this is a bogus cause or what, but that can't be the goal of the fighting when the fighting breaks out. When it comes to the crisis and you're in a hot war, persuasion is not your main tool.
Even, is that true now, though? So it's not a hot war yet, is it? So we're still in the Cold War phase of the culture war,
right?
Where it's still being fought through electoral processes. But is it sort of, don't worry about persuading the people as much as get the power and do the good thing with it. Use the power for good and a bunch of, and let the chips fall.
No, in the Cold War phase, there's a big middle. There are the bad guys on the extreme other end, and then the good guys on the other end. And then there's a big middle where 80% of the population is. And up until that middle is going to have to decide what direction to break when the crisis hits. And until that crisis hits, we should be seeking to be persuasive to them. If hot-blooded Christian nationalists say, all that matters is for us to seize power and find out who the Franco is and install him, you're going to lose a bunch of that 80%, and rightly so, because you're being an idiot. Don't lose the people whose support would be necessary, right? So you want to be persuasive to them as long as persuasion is reasonable. But when the zeros are flying overhead, no.
And people may not be comfortable calling their fellow citizens enemies, but it's a matter of figuring out if that person is a threat. So they may be more comfortable saying that. So some individuals really are enemies.
And are a threat to your
way
of life.
The left itself is a threat to your way of life. And so evaluating whether someone is a threat is not a wise thing to do. It's not a pugilistic attitude just to think through. Is my way of life going to be better or worse because
would my neighbor on this side report me for
exactly. Yeah.
And I mean just some basic, this were basic Christianity. Look, the trans person walking down Main Street with flaming hair and no clothes on is an enemy to your way of life, a genuine threat. Mm-hmm. And you might say, well, not a threat to me. Yes, but it's a threat to society. It's a threat to the true good and beautiful. But we're Christians. And so we're always saying, come without money and buy. Come and see that the Lord is good.
Love your enemy. Well,
and we believe that in any moment, that enemy can be converted into a friend.
Right.
So that simple basic Christianity helps you to get over this problem. Is that an enemy? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's an enemy. But we're looking for that person's good just as much as our
own. The Lord's teaching that we must love our enemies is mandatory. We must love our enemies. But pop evangelicalism has taken that to mean you must not have any enemies. And if you have any enemies at all, you're failing it.
You're hating them.
You're failing at the winsome department, and you're hating them. So we should have enemies and love them, which means that if they're converted, we rejoice. We're not full of bile and bitterness, and we think
and
that's
we can
wonderful.
And you can restrain their activity, right? So, like, I think part of it is when it comes to the political questions, it's, you know, are we willing to use, you know, the power of the state if we could get it, if we persuade enough people through electorals, if they don't cheat, if it's not close, and all of a sudden, so I think, you know, one of the things that's happening right now in the Christians evaluating, do I stick with Trump or not? Do I vote for Trump or not? Do I not vote? Well, if he has a bunch of Christians in his administration, and there's a bunch of leftists who are really, really nervous about that, right? That's that's the scare tactic now, is to do,
right.
It's going to be staffed with a bunch of Christian nationalists who are, I saw one today, where on the one hand, they were really, really worried because these Christian nationalists are going to get in, they're going to ban surrogacy. And not only that, they're going to turn women into incubators. Like, it was in the same clip. In the same clip, it was, they were really worried that Christians were going to ban surrogacy, and at the same time were massively concerned that Christians were going to turn women into incubators for babies. And I just thought, they claiming to be wise, they became fools. You just can't, like, that is just giving them over to just no self-awareness. But they're concerned about, not like Trump's a problem because he's a wrecking ball, but it's the folks who might be willing to staff a Trump administration and actually use state power.
If Trump is elected, the White House will be full of evangelicals.
Right.
And the Book of Proverbs, Scripture has a lot to say about banish the wicked from the king's presence, and good things happen.
Good things,
right?
Yeah.
And so that's a. This whole, a lot of American Christians particularly feel like their vote is a sacrament.
Yeah.
And they feel like it's like taking the Lord's Supper. And I can't cast a vote for a person like Trump, who obviously has got issues, which is true.
Yeah.
Right. That's true.
Because that would taint the sacrament.
Taint this. You're tolerating some sort of untoward business in this because this is sacramental. But ironically, that's an idolatry of the political process.
Right.
You're not, if I'm captured by pirates and this group of pirates wants to make me walk the plank and this group of pirates wants to burn me in a week after we get to shore, I'll go with the pirates. But I'm not supporting either one.
Yeah,
you know,
if they give you a vote, you
if
know,
they give me a vote, I'm saying
I'll go with those guys,
or pretend to go with those guys to the briar patch. You know,
But that, I think that's right, because I do think a lot of evangelicals view their vote in very, like, it's a symbolic significance is actually more important than the practical significance, which I suppose is part of that myth of like, this is sacred democracy that we're a part of and participating in it, as opposed to a more, I don't know, there's like almost like a pragmatic, prudential, whatever you want to say, element of like, if the question is which candidate, president or down the line, is going to help to me to be able to preserve my way of life. If that's the calculus, which one's best able, which one's the greater threat, lesser threat? So it could be lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
It could be this one actually allows for possibilities that one doesn't. That one's clear, a more clear and present danger. And so it's much more of a real politic kind of calculation.
And somebody who can see enemies, domestic enemies, somebody who can point that out. So not just preserve, but preserve as opposed to let these guys.
Yeah.
Your point about people are afraid that the Christian nationalists are going to get in and
do
govern
stuff.
Things. Okay, so there are the idiots that Doug alluded to earlier that are saying dumb things about what they're going to do. But I don't think the solution to that is kind of going back to the old guard where we paper over things and be like, oh no, we're going to get power and we will keep things just the same. Like, we won't change anything. There is a way to move forward saying, well, of course we're going to use power, as all people do. Of course we're going to legislate morality, as all laws do. We can tell you why they're good. So I have a grandfather that, you know, back in the day he owned an apartment building, and you know, we're going to rent it out here. So people show up, and when the guy and the girl show up with no ring on, he was just, well, you know, this just isn't for you. This just isn't for you. You know, what do you mean? You want, well, I can tell you why. I mean, this it's not good for you. You this wouldn't be what you this wouldn't be good for you.
Yeah.
And I think we need to strike that tone as we're recovering law, legislation, all of it. Just yeah, we're gonna have some laws on the books that haven't that used to be in the books back when things, you know, weren't burning. And we can tell you. So we need that kind of rhetorical stance on legislation.
Mm-hmm. And the standard would be whether God's happy with the laws and not whether the left or whether you're being called authoritarian.
Right.
So it doesn't just because you're being called that doesn't mean that you are. It might be a good thing that you're doing.
Well, and it seems like I think part of the struggle for a lot of folks is they want the persuasion to happen before the law happens. And what you just said is, no, I'm going to do the law and then afterward I'll give you the reasons.
Super bad when the law happens after their persuasion. That's not how God's designed,
right?
I mean, it's like it doesn't do that way with kids. Like, you know, the table doesn't move when the kid whacks his head on it. The law is there. Now but then the other danger is we think, well, I shouldn't be in the business of persuasion at all. No, we absolutely are in the business of persuasion, but you're in the business of persuasion acknowledging that the Tao is what it is. It's there. And by all means, we're eager to talk to you about it and explain why it is what it is.
Let me go back to an earlier point, the point about Franco, because there's another subtlety here that a lot of people miss. We've been, Christians are praying for a Josiah. Lord, give us a Josiah, a true reformer who loves the Lord God
in his heart.
That's what we want. We really do want a Josiah. And if one were on the ballot, I would vote for Josiah. So we're praying for Josiah, but it looks like God's giving us a Jehu.
Yeah.
Okay.
And an Ahab.
Right.
You know, like the choice between Jehu.
The house of Ahab and Jehu. And I would tell Christians in this juncture, take the Jehu, mm-hmm. right? Say, oh, Lord, you're sovereign over these things, and I wish I could have voted for a Josiah, but it looks like you're giving us a Jehu. So then that happens. Going back to Franco, I don't think we should be saying, oh man, I wish we had a Franco. That's what my mm-hmm. comment earlier was.
Yeah.
But I think that I would way prefer Franco to the commies.
Right.
Right. In the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah.
So the Franco has got a bad name.
Because he won.
Because he won and because he was on the right. Right.
Yeah.
Had the Spanish communists won
and done the same
and ushered in the kind of appalling behavior that communists everywhere have done.
Yep.
They would be.
Whoever that guy would be on t-shirts at college campuses.
That guy would be on t-shirts. Exactly. Yeah. And so if God gave us a Franco instead of a commie totalitarian, mm-hmm. Thank God for thank God for
buying
that mild mercy.
Mild mercy.
No. Right. But that's not what we want. What we want is a God-fearing, sincere faith all the way.
Yeah.
And playing that out, I was talking to somebody recently about this. I do think that, well, I'm just gaming it out. I think after Trump, there will be a desire for a leader with some magnanimity, like mm-hmm. with some substance, you know, with that kind of thing. I wonder, I'm just, you know, maybe not, but I think that we're kind of there. I think Trump is still obviously hitting remarkably hard and we're all still fed up. And I think people are going to go for Trump, but I don't know it's hitting as hard as like his first go round. Right. Mm-hmm. It's a different game. And I do wonder if there's like in the rising tide of people to be, okay, good. We needed that at that moment. And now I don't know that you want another Trump after Trump. No. And it usually doesn't work that way. The next guy's got to have that maybe that quality that wasn't as robust in him.
Well, and I don't trust Trump to build the new world. Maybe to build the wall, maybe.
Yeah, but, maybe.
But we really do need to get that.
Yeah, that should happen. But the next phase should be built. I mean, if we're wishing and not looking for just trade-offs, then yeah, it should be a Josiah.
Yeah.
One question before we end. Going back to the right, do we have like a coalition that's strong enough, tied close enough, like close knit enough to achieve anything? Would this require that like something like Netter is important to sort of sheepdog that coalition?
Yeah, so yeah, but I think part of the question is I thought about this too whenever you said you got people on the right say stupid stuff. How much time do you spend swatting down the stupid stuff in order to appeal? Because the goal there is, you said there's this 80% in the middle who the stupid stuff really turns them off and alienates. And so do you swat that down in order to appeal to the middle? And how is that different than sort of the third way?
So I would distinguish between the person to my right who says something dumb, and I'd say, you know, I don't think that that's the way we want to go. That's a jockeying for a leadership position on the same side.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So it's like a primary election.
Right.
You have 10 Republicans running for the nomination, and they've all committed to support the nominee, whoever it is.
Right.
That was what they used to do back in the old days.
Interesting. Okay.
And so you've got there. That's a critiquing someone on your side is a leadership issue. It's not an enemy. A person is not an enemy simply because I don't think that's the way to go.
Which is different than trying to get them doxxed and canceled and fired from their job
and ruin their life.
Which is to treat them like an enemy.
Right. Now where the Netter principle, no enemies to the right, gets its traction, and I think where it has a great deal of legitimacy, is let's say there's someone to my right who there's a an allegation that hits the news that he tweeted something racist in high school.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, here's the scandal. And then all the responsible leaders pull their skirts away before they know anything about whether it's true.
Right.
You know, it's just sort of a flinch away. And I think that we ought to have the Netter principle with regard to the flinch.
Yeah.
We should say, okay, I'm not gonna have an enemy to the right simply because the left is demanding that I denounce this guy. Yep. That I'm wholeheartedly in favor of Netter. I'm not going to denounce someone simply because someone I've already denounced is demanding that I denounce him.
Yeah, right. Perform it that way. very good. Hey guys, thanks for doing this. We'll be back again. It's 2024 has 12 months. So
one month closer to the election.
That's right. We'll be back for, and who knows what we'll talk about. We'll come back. So thanks for joining us for Doug and Friends. We'll see you next time.
If you enjoyed this episode and are curious about the original video, check it out at canonplus.com. It's an episode of The Wade Show with Wade entitled, Why Everything is Political Now. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.